Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for getting up earlier, perhaps than usual, or not as the case may be. I'd like to make a welcome to you on behalf of the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, and thank you very much indeed for coming today. I'd also like to thank Eva Grossman and her colleagues at the Centre for Democracy and Peacebuilding for co-organising this with the Institute for Conflict Research and all of our colleagues here today. This is a very auspicious occasion, and it isn't a very auspicious day. As you know already, it is the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz and the 20th anniversary of the ending of the war in Srebrenica, Bosnia. I'd like to thank our speakers today, Daniel Greenberg, an eminent barrister specialising in legislation. Daniel's a member of the parliamentary team at Bow and Leighton Partners, where he advises on statutory interpretation, the legislative process and the machinery of government. He's the editor of a number of judicial dictionaries and publications, and he trains legislative drafters, civil servants in the UK and abroad, teaching and writing about halakha, Jewish law and ethics. Daniel will be in conversation with John Alderdice. Lord Alderdice was elevated to the peerage in 1996 as Baron Alderdice of Knock in the city of Belfast. Now an Oxford-based academic, he was formerly a practising psychiatrist, and as leader of the Northern Ireland Alliance Party, he played a key role in the negotiation of the 1998 Belfast Good Friday Agreement. He became first Speaker of the New Northern Ireland Assembly and, on retirement in 2004, was appointed to the IMC. He currently sits on the UK Committee on Standards in Public Life. Daniel and John will be chaired in conversation by the Attorney General for Northern Ireland, John F. Larkin, QC. He's the first person to hold the office separately since its functions were assumed by the Attorney General for England and Wales in 1972 and the only non-politician to do so. John was called to the Bar of Northern Ireland in 1986 and later to the Bar of Ireland. In 1989, at the tender age of 25, I believe, John was appointed Reed Professor of Criminal Law, Criminology and Penal Law at Trinity College Dublin. And it's perhaps worth noting that this post has been held by both past presidents of Ireland, Mary Robinson and Mary McAleese. There are many events taking place this week to mark the anniversary. This morning's conversation, The Ethics of Memory and Community Recovery, is a particularly important one as it brings together three very great minds to grapple with the legacy of conflict in the context of transgenerational traumas that has burdened citizens in other countries and, in the absence of a victims commissioner here, continues to burden our community. We're privileged that this conversation will cover the realms of human and moral rights and wrongs, of psychosocial healing and of community recovery. The Holocaust and subsequent genocides of Cambodia, Rwanda, Darfur and Bosnia have each brought lessons in policy and legislative changes. They have also, just as importantly, brought lessons in moral developments and human recovery. Questions in relation to the appropriation of history as a tool to justify hatred and hurts are not news to us on these islands. We're also slap bang in the middle of a series of events that have been designed to commemorate a decade of centenaries connected to the formation of the State of Northern Ireland and marked by bloodshed that has been used to justify divergent national agendas. Before I hand over to the Attorney General, I would like to start by suggesting that while dealing with the past is rightly a preoccupation for many of us in the North, it's not yet adequately being considered collectively and publicly. Perhaps this is because our recent past is still in that strange limbo where the interface between history and myth-making is blurred and emerging. Today's conversation and exchanges between the speakers and you, the audience, will prove us with an opportunity to explore and to question the objectivity of collective memory in critical history and in psychological authenticity. Ladies and gentlemen, the Attorney General.
Thanks very much, JT. Well, it's a huge honour to have been asked to chair this conversation this morning, and I'm very much looking forward to your contributions. But it's a particular pleasure for me to be joined in the formal part of conversation by John Alderdice and Daniel Greenberg. As you know, I have the misfortune of being a lawyer. John is a lawmaker, so a member of the Upper House of Parliament. And Daniel still writes legislation. It's a skill which other lawyers, I think, are still somewhat in awe of. And I think if that leads inevitably to a certain skewing of perspective, we look to you, I think, for a correction. It's no secret, of course, that I've spoken about the relationship between law and our past and the relative roles and responsibilities of law and history, and how we may, as a community, have asked law and lawyers to bear burdens and responsibilities that are perhaps more appropriately directed to history and historians. But of course, I think we have to be careful about the uses and misappropriations of history, and that's something that in this part of the world we're all perhaps lamentably familiar with. One of the examples that I want to sort of kick off the conversation with, and I certainly don't want to hog this longer than I ought to, is by looking at some of the ways in which we use law. We're, of course, used to the idea of law commanding and forbidding. But I've been struck recently by the recent French experience. On a number of occasions, the French Parliament has enacted so-called memorial laws. It has done one in relation to the Holocaust. It has also done, more controversially, one in relation to the Armenian genocide of 1915. And in 2012, the French Parliament, Senate, National Assembly, passed a law recognising the 1915 Armenian genocide. It then subsequently enacted legislation which penalised any denial of a genocide recognised by French law. Now, that was, as a matter of French constitutional law, fascinating for me, I know, but perhaps a little less for some of the rest of you, was referred to the French Conseil Constitutionnel, whereupon it was struck down. And the decision is very short, it's perhaps only a matter of three pages, but in essence, what the French Conseil Constitutionnel held, well, it wasn't open to Parliament to forbid discussion or denial of a genocide that it had itself protected in law. That was an excessive interference with free speech protected as a matter of French constitutional law. Now, for my part, I think I would be more indulgent to memorial laws than perhaps the Conseil Constitutionnel laws. I think that although we are used, of course, to laws permitting, forbidding, prescribing, there is no reason why we can't use laws more creatively. And it seems to me as appropriate to use a law to memorialise as it is to erect a statue or to prescribe a moment's silence. Now, about 18 months ago, I tried to cheer up some civil servants by pointing out to them that probably one of Europe's most prolific and successful lawmakers wasn't trained as a lawyer, and his sole training was that of an artillery officer. Of course, the reference was to Napoleon. Daniel immediately pointed out, of course, that schooling in artillery was an excellent training for lawmakers. One had to be on target, one hadn't to use an excessive charge, one had to avoid collateral damage. So I've given up, I must say, predicting what Daniel will say on any subject. I hazard, though, that he may be rather less sympathetic to memorial laws than I am, so I hand over to him to respond.
Is that all right? I'll pick this up. I mean, this takes us bang into the middle of what we're here to discuss, because a memorial law, in artillery terms, is firing a blank. It's a phenomenally important thing to do, and it can make a big noise, and it can focus attention, and it can act as a centrepiece for a memorial, for people coming together to think about something, but you just have to remember that a blank doesn't have any charge. And when the noise has gone away, what is the result of it? Nothing, because it is a blank. So there may be occasions when we want to misuse law, in the sense that if I'm the quartermaster, I would tell you it's very nice for the people to come along and want to have days when they fire blanks to make lots of noise for the for the assembled masses, but that ain't a proper use of ammunition. It ain't a proper use of law to make a noise. And I think your point was exactly right when you say that as lawyers, as historians, as politicians, as all kinds of professionals, one of the things that we need to be careful of when we come to discuss the ethics of memory is having our particular expertise and roles misused by others and taken by others as ways of expressing thoughts and ideas that perhaps they could express much more creatively and constructively, and it wouldn't just be firing a blank if they found other ways to do it. It's my opening shot.
That's not a blank, either.
Yeah.
I suppose for someone who spends a good deal of his life involved in the law-making process, I sit more likely to it as a way of dealing with these kinds of problems. My background, I think, in psychiatry, I mean, working in areas of conflict in various parts of the world, is probably more important to me as I think about it. We're all familiar with memory because as we grow up as individuals, we remember things more or less accurately. You know, if you talk to your kids about how they remember their childhood, each of them has a different memory of the childhood they shared. And all of them have a very different memory of it than you have as a parent. So it's a very interesting thing, memory. But the memory of every individual is time-limited. I mean, in the end, your memory and my memory is not going to go on beyond our lifetime. But the memory of a community is a quite different phenomenon in the sense that it can go on for hundreds, indeed thousands of years. The community of which you're a part celebrates things that go back 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years and remembers them more or less in a particular kind of way. So this notion of memory is a very important one to understand from a human perspective. And there are a number of things about it. We're used to the idea that there's a past, you know, what we did before we came in this morning. There's here, what you're experiencing currently. And there's the potential future, what you hope or fear might happen for the rest of the day, or much further down the line. And we kind of think of that as obvious. But actually, as a very young baby, you don't have that. You simply have perception. You simply have the experience of what has happened. And if your mother disappears for 10 seconds, she doesn't exist anymore. We call it object constancy. The person hasn't got the capacity at that stage of development to remember, my mother was there, she went away before and she came back. If she's not there, she doesn't exist anymore. And there's no sense of future either. There's no hope, fear or anything of that kind at that stage. So this notion that we can separate experience out into past, present and future is a development. It's something we achieve. A bit like getting bowel and bladder control or standing up and walking and so on. These are achievements which can be lost. And you will know that in an elderly relative, that they can lose the capacity to distinguish between past and present, even to distinguish between different people. They'll talk about the past as though it was here now, for example. They'll talk about you as though you were their sister rather than their daughter. So this capacity can be gained and it can be lost. It's the same with communities. You can gain the capacity to put things into the past and make them memories, but you can lose that capacity. And time can be intervening so that something that you knew happened 300 years ago can be experienced as though it was happening now, as though it happened last month. And these things happen when individual people or communities of people are under threat. So, for example, if people are suffering from PTSD, they're not suffering from memories that cause them a problem. They're suffering from the fact that they can't make those into memories. They can only experience them as though they were horribly continuing to go on and on and on. So the importance of all of this is that when somebody says, draw a line into the past, or someone says, forget about it, or somebody in this glorious building says, I'm going to wear a t-shirt that says, the Titanic sunk, get over it. Actually, that doesn't solve the problem. If for various reasons, it's still around in the here and now of people. And even passing a law doesn't make it so. So I think this notion of how we deal with the past is really, I mean, Holocaust Memorial Day, one of the great challenges for all of us, but not least for Jewish people, are things like remembering Jewish people were not the only people who suffered in the Holocaust. Finding ways of saying the Holocaust is terrible and it must be remembered so that we don't repeat it. But if we get completely captured by it, then we end up with this problem.
One of the tags for the Holocaust is always good to be. One of the tags for all of this is lest we forget. And I've always thought that the longer we go on, the more important it is to have another tag, lest we only remember. Because, I mean, we're talking about the ethics of memory. And as you say, John, in a sense, you start by thinking, well, what is my ethics of memory? I mean, it's actually like the ethics of a broken leg. If I'd have got a broken leg, we haven't got a broken leg. But then you realise, exactly as you're saying, that we do have control. Well, some of us have control. Or we can help other people to begin to have control over memory in a way that we can't in relation to a broken leg. And we all know people who live in the past, whether that be the Holocaust or other dreadful things that have happened to them, and they, exactly as you would say, they live in the past in a way that is horrendously damaging to them, and you only have to talk to children of some Holocaust survivors to realise that there are whole generations who felt unable to get over wrongs that happened to their parents. And they are affected by it. They are more deleterious to their development than they are to their parents' development. So, yeah, lest we forget, incredibly important, although can we honestly claim that the memory of the Holocaust has prevented, and I mean, we certainly really want to throw out things that people hopefully react to early on, so do that. But can we claim that the memory of the Holocaust has actually prevented any piece of inhumane behaviour from human beings regarded in any other part of the world? I would love to say we could. Personally, I have no evidence. If anybody does have any evidence, the only evidence I have is that brutality seems to be very much a stopping trade of people around the world. And nobody stopped and said, hold on, we're going down a little bit, like we're going a little foot too far towards Nazi Germany. We're going into, I've never heard that said, and I've never seen any evidence that politicians or others really learn that lesson in a practical way. Maybe that's something being seen to discuss it. So I think, yes, lest we forget, but I'm totally with you, lest we only remember and can never move on.
And I think one of the complicating factors, of course, is, and you've touched on this, Daniel, is the initial difficulty about applying various ethics to memory.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that the cardinal principle of an ethics of memory has to be the centrality of truth. Truth and a commitment to truth isn't inconsistent, I think, with factual accuracy, but it's absolutely dependent on the good faith of the person engaged in the exercise. One can make a mistake and think that something happened, but if one irons out the inconvenient creases in narrative to make one's role rather better than it was, then different considerations arise. I mean, I'm struck in this context by, you know, if you look at modern historiography and the amount of ink that's been expended on the Scholls and the Stauffenbergs and the Van Moltkes, one would get a particular impression of their relative importance in the period in which they live. But I would love to think that were so, but I really don't think it is, that they were not particularly representative of the time.
I mean, let's start by doing some disagreement here, because it's going to get extremely boring if we only agree with each other. So I'm going to disagree with something that both of my colleagues have said about. I don't think truth and memory have anything to do with each other. I think truth is a matter of history. fact. And I think as soon as something becomes a question of truth or falsehood, it's actually ceased to be an issue of memory, and it has now found its place in history. It's where you can assert what did happen or didn't happen. But you said, John, that by and large one's memory is right. Now, I mean, I think perhaps you're being kind to us, but in your professional capacity, you know much better than we do, that actually it's incredible how much a person's memory can be wrong, can be true to them, absolutely true to them, and in factual terms, as you said, completely untrue. I remember I was talking once on Holocaust subjects with a group of students, and I said something about the Holocaust, and I said how I thought we had actually failed to learn very rapidly. The victims, talking of the community, had failed to learn some of the obvious lessons very fast. And one of them turned around to me and said, one of the students said, "Would you say that to a Holocaust survivor?" And I said, "No, of course I would. It would be a grossly insensitive thing to say to a Holocaust survivor, because the Holocaust survivor is dealing with memory and actual a reality which doesn't permit of the same kind of objectivity that if somebody didn't start a person, you know, I ought to be able to bring to it. So again, lest we forget, perhaps it's about making sure that as it does move from the era of personal memory into history, because that's what's happening now, to be clear, a last few personal survivors are still giving their personal stories today. In 5 years' time, that's 10 years' time, it's going to be that. So it's moving from memory into history, from memory into fact, and perhaps therefore it becomes more important that we allow it to turn into constructive history while still allowing those who have subjective memory to live the way they need to deal with those subjective memories. I mean, John, is that in profession? Is that what you said?
Well, let me then sort of take it a little further, because I'm not at all sure about this notion of truth or about history being fact.
Yeah.
It seems to me history is the memory of various communities. And it can vary a very great deal. And very different histories can be written about the same events and are. And the notion that historians are particularly objective is an interesting myth too. So let me put it in this kind of way. I remember seeing a lady for a period of time whose husband had died. He was a very eminent man. She was very, very devoted to him. Life was great fun with him. They didn't have any family. I'm not sure by choice or otherwise. And after he died, she went into quite a brief reaction, and she came along to see me. And after a number of months of seeing her every week, I thought, we're getting absolutely nowhere. She can talk about this, and she can talk about it endlessly with me, but actually she's not getting any better. And so I said to her, you know, it seems to me that it's very difficult for you to allow your husband to be dead. And she said, I have no intention of allowing him to be dead. What did he mean going and dying and leaving me? I mean, I had a good life with him, and he just went and died. Well, I'm not having it, and I'm going to keep him alive for as long as I'm alive. Well, over the next week or two, I withdrew from the case, because it was quite clear to me that actually this lady didn't, for various rather interesting reasons, didn't want him to be dead. This is one of the dilemmas in dealing with memory and the legacy of memory in these situations. There can be situations where communities don't want the past to be the past. So although it's spoken about as memory, it's not actually that. It's continuing to keep it alive for various reasons. And unless we can help people get to the point where they don't need to keep it alive, then they will never become memories, and they won't be able to be dealt with. So, for example, you were speaking about the commemorations that there have been over the last little while. For some people, those commemorations are proper memories. They're recognizing something that happened, and they're appreciating that the relationship between the countries involved is now different. For some people, they're not allowed to be memories. The fight is still going on. And that's the challenge at a community level. And it's one of the dilemmas. If you don't let that happen, then never again actually becomes a paradox, because what happens is it gets repeated. the person who was abused becomes an abuser rather than someone who's able to let go and let it be the past. And, you know, this can be a big danger for a community.
Absolutely. No, I'm
just on this interplay with between memory and truth, and again, responding to Daniel's invitation, that we must sort of rough it up a bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, well, as a matter of personal ethics, one doesn't use the truth to injure. I think the relationship between memory and truth is inextricable, because if you think you've left your umbrella in the hat stand outside, but I know you've left it in your car, I'll tell you where you've left your umbrella. Objectively, your umbrella is either in one place or t'other, and I will try to keep you right about that. Of course, you're right that history struggles with accuracy, and history is written from perspectives. But I think difficulty in capturing the objective truth or an objective truth doesn't mean that there isn't it. So Daniel's umbrella is either in his car or in the hat stand. By all means, let's try and work out where it is. But it doesn't have the gift of bilocation. It's in one place or the other.
That's fine with umbrellas.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when it comes to, did you attack me because you hate me, or because you misunderstood me, or because you misinterpreted something that happened, and the history
of those
kinds of issues, then the truth becomes a much more problematic. I'll give you an example. When we're talking about parading in North Belfast, and I introduced the notion that actually the Pope of the time was not so disappointed about William's victory, and perhaps that was something that could be celebrated. It was made quite clear to me that actually this was not a matter of great interest, whether the Pope was positive about this or not. The fact of that was not actually massively influential, and they weren't likely to welcome the priest at Ardoin coming out to share the celebration with them. In fact, that would rather it would have rather done away with the whole point of the exercise. So the accuracy of history, it seems to me, is a very curiously flimsy thing.
But that's a different issue, and that's, I think, the comforting power of myth versus, you know, what some dusty historian turned up in an archive 200 years later. Their myth, and I think so. We talked about memory, we talked about truth, talked about history. I think the other strain that we need to engage with here is myth. For example, I was struck. There's been a lot of really good archaeological research done at Masada recently, and it appears, in fact, that there weren't, you know, hundreds of zealots at the last stand. But that doesn't detract one jot from the resonance of Masada, for example, as something totemic for the Israeli Defense Forces.
Well, that's a really fascinating example, because it takes us right back to your umbrella case and John's reaction to it. I mean, we all know that we know a few little scratchy facts about what happened on Masada. And we know there was an umbrella here and an umbrella there. But the location of the umbrella doesn't get you any further. Everybody who has an agenda about anything will take those scratchy facts and turn them into great support. You know, the fact that there were these people on Masada tells you that. Anything you like. I mean, I always get really cross, just going on a slight tangent, if I may. I get really cross when you have, I suspect this happens in all communities, and probably in political communities as well. It certainly happens in religious communities. You have, unhappily will happen, a tragedy. There'll be a traffic accident. And a child will and this happened, this is an exact case happened, the child was injured getting out of the car, school bus reverses, child I think was killed, and instantly everybody's got a reason what we can learn from this. Everybody's agenda comes in, we can learn, you know, this shows that God doesn't like mobile telephones. Whatever it is, everybody's got an immediate reason. Masada will show anything you want it to show. And what it shows is you need to be very careful when you reverse a school bus. That is the lesson to learn from a child being injured behind a school bus. So the danger, the further it goes back into memory, the more your little scratchy objective facts become open to interpretation any way anybody wants, and suddenly
the Holocaust can be made to prove anything that you want, from the dangers of the German people to the dangers of the Jewish people and everything in between, including the dangers of mobile telephones. So I think it's back to taming memory and making it into something constructive and not something that just eats people away in the way that you were describing, or that historians then you know, pin down an objective fact and then and then you know, monopolise that.
No, but I think the taming memory, I think, starts with facts. The interpretation is the harder beast to tame. But yes. I think if one establishes facts, then one contributes.
But which facts? I agree. Which facts do you choose to establish? Because again, you know, there are going to be millions of possible facts, and I can by building up facts that are pure facts, and telling you the location of a certain number of umbrellas where you can't doubt where they were, I can build up a radically different picture from someone who chooses to take a different set of facts.
This is where law habitually sort of plays jumping pool with these kind of issues and insists on concepts like the material facts. So someone decides are the important facts, the material facts, and we move from there.
Let me take the dilemma of the French parliamentary decision. As some of you will know, the reason this is an issue is because Turkey has never accepted that there was a genocide of Armenians. And in Turkey, to say that there was a genocide has exactly the opposite effect of what the parliamentarians in France are deciding. So France can decide this about a completely other country, miles away, and the only impact it has is to damage foreign relations. It doesn't have any other... Any Turk that comes to France and talks about what he could perfectly legitimately believe in Turkey now has to believe something different. It's a bit like the Queen when she crosses the border to Scotland. She moves from being an Anglican to being a Presbyterian, you know, as though it actually means anything at all in terms of what she really believes. And the problem about the fact business and putting it into legislation is it doesn't actually change how people feel if how they feel is frightened, is angry, is disturbed, or whatever. Passing a law doesn't necessarily change that. And so for us, and indeed for people in Israel, one of the problems about remembering and about never again is if I remember things in a particular kind of way and say, I'm never going to do that again, we will never let that happen again, it has the same effect as a parent who grows up saying, I'm never going to behave with my children the way my parents behaved with me. Because 10 chances to one, 20 years on, they'll suddenly say, oh my goodness, I've just heard myself saying what my father said to me. Or I've just said it in the same tone of voice as my mother said to me. Why? Because it never was allowed to become a memory. It got captured.
It became an obsession.
It became an obsession. And one of the terrible dangers is that Jewish people actually do things in Israel, not outside, but in Israel, as a government, that have turned many people against Israel instead of being sympathetic by doing things that actually many of them are uncomfortable about doing. So it's a real problem, this finding a way of turning things from being a current, continuing, horrible experience into a memory that we can think about but aren't captured by.
I mean, without probably wanting, I suspect we don't want to go too far into details of Israeli politics this morning, but I don't think you will find anybody who agrees that a person who's suffered, a community who's suffered as a victim, needs to find ways of avoiding that becoming an obsession, which can lead to aberrant behaviour of all sorts of kinds, and allows that victimhood to influence the way they behave in a positive way. And do I personally think that the Jewish community worldwide, throughout the world, has learnt all the lessons we can from the whole Holocaust experience? No, I don't. I very much don't. I suppose perhaps one of the reasons is that, of course, what are the ways that one deals with community victimhood after the event? You use law, you use politics, One of the things you don't do, which you do with an individual victim, is sit down with somebody from your profession, John. There is no community psychiatrist or community psychologist to sit and work with a community. And, I mean, I saw this, if I may, in Myanmar. I've been in Myanmar a couple of times recently, training them in their democratic delivery program. Here's a country that wants to become a democracy, by which I mean desperately wants to become. And you only have to look at the light in the eyes of some of these young civil servants who think, yes, we could be a rule of law country, to realise there's a real desire there. But there are two classes there. There are two groups. One of them, one group, the eldest of the servants, are so affected by what happened to them that they cannot look objectively at the notion of a rule of law, because it involves cancelling out all sorts of debts and grudges that they haven't got a chance to work through. And the youngsters, who haven't experienced it personally, and they're already coming through, I can already see them going through, they don't know what the fuss is about. And the ability to have somebody come in and say, well, let's sit down and learn from it and talk about it, and as you would do with one of your professional patients, that we can't do. And law, I mean, coming back to where you started us, law is such a blunt instrument, and it cannot heal. It can order, or it can make a huge noise. But neither of those is really involved in helping people heal.
Well, one of the things that I think law can do, at least sort of contemporary European human rights law can arguably do, is mark out the state. It's kind of struck by the reference to the French experience and the Czech experience, because there have been a pair of cases that have come to the European Court of Human Rights in a very short time. One's a Czech citizen of Armenian origin who was convicted of insulting Turkishness by reason of his writings about the Armenian genocide. The other was a Turkish journalist who was convicted in Switzerland of denying the Armenian genocide, which again, a bit like France, was prohibited as a matter of Swiss federal law. Both of these cases made their way to Strasbourg. There was a grand chamber decision in the Turkish case and a chamber decision in the Swiss case. It's going back to the grand chamber. And in both cases, the Strasbourg court struck down, found a violation of Article 10 on the basis that there has to be space for the conversation. The Armenian journalist in Turkey, who was subsequently murdered, by the way, was writing in a respectful way. He was talking about the relationship between Turks and Armenians. He was pointing out, in fact, that the Armenian obsession with the genocide was actually rendering their relationship toxic the host Turks. Similarly, the political point was being made by the Turkish journalists in Switzerland. Look, this was 1915, there was a war, the Armenians were a fifth column, to use an anachronistic term. They were largely favourable to the Tsarist Russia. That was Turkey's enemy. Yes, there were great displacements of people, but in a major conflict, these happened. I mean, these were intellectually respectable points by both secret journalists and both journalists, in fact. And the court carved out the states for them to make those points.
I agree with that.
The difficulty, I think, is that, to my knowledge, it speaks of its correction, we haven't had a case in relation to Holocaust to now. I suspect that's simply that's a fringe inhabited by toxic nutters. What do you think?
I think one needs to be very careful to live in the whole world and not just in the Western world.
Yeah.
Because you can pass whatever you like in Strasbourg, but it doesn't actually affect what leading figures and populations as a whole believe about things and that are driving features. In the Islamic world outside of the West, a far, very substantial majority of people believe that 9/11 was conducted by Israeli secret service in collusion with the CIA. It doesn't matter what kind of evidence you adduce for that not being true, Millions and millions of people around the world believe that to be the case. Unless you just think it's in that part of the world, a majority of people in the Republican Party in the United States believe that Obama is a Muslim. So, you know, it's not a question of one part of the world. Reality, law, and fact are remarkably weak when it comes to dealing with powerful emotional issues. That's not to say they're not important. They absolutely are. And human rights law is extremely important. But if we're trying to change people's attitudes, the question is, what might be the equivalent of addressing emotions? And I think there are things like the creative arts and writing, not just writing about the facts or journalistic reporting, but making films and plays and drawing people's attention to things in a way that affects them emotionally. And we're very much aware, and looking around here, there are many people here who are very much aware of the power of emotion in a community, and that there are things that you can do of a symbolic nature that may be powerfully positive or powerfully negative. Sport, for example, can be both powerfully positive and powerfully negative, and lots of other activities. So I think if we want to change how people feel about things, we also have to find ways of getting in touch with those feelings.
Which is much more difficult, and for political leaders, of course, you cannot give an instruction to artists to go out and perpetuate a memory in a positive direction by producing good art. You can have a law, you can have it tomorrow. And I mean, I'm more with you on the potential benefits of law creating space. I like that. I do think that's right, and I agree, John, it has limitations. Obviously, we can't create space throughout the world, but I do get that. And I think telling people what they can and can't do with memory is quite important. Telling people that memory will not justify certain kinds of behaviour. I think that's very important. Telling people that the fact that some people may have memory which is very precious to them means that insulting that memory may become a kind of assault, which is probably already covered by the criminal law, that it wouldn't be for certain other people. I get all of that, but I think it's back to, none of us have mentioned yet the word education, but you've come as close to it as anybody, and art educates in a way that nothing else can, because you think about Holocaust denial and all the rest of it, and we might get into that. I have slightly ambivalent views about that. But if you stand in front of a picture that was painted by somebody who lived through, whether it be Rwanda or Germany or Bosnia, who lived through anything and painted their suffering onto canvas, you can't argue about that, because that is an expression of raw emotion. And you stand there, and then you ask yourself the question, why? And you want to find out from the artist what that represents. Now, a law can't do that, and telling people what to say or what not to say can't inspire them to want to find out what this memory can do for them. And I've got someone sitting over there suffering. Most of us are inspired to go and want to help, but also to learn. And because it's not being forced at me, and it's not being, and I must tell you, that's not, it's not fair, but one of my children didn't want to go on the Poland march because she said, I'm not yet ready to have, she didn't use the word manipulate, and she certainly didn't mean it she wouldn't have meant that in a destructive way, but she was aware that there was emotions she wasn't yet ready to feel, and when she was ready to confront them, she wanted to go and confront them in her way and not have them shoved at her. And law shoves things at people. I mean, that's what it's for. So I think the ethics, coming back to this whole idea of the ethics of memory, must be, as you say, about space and freedom. And people must be given the freedom to express their memories. And we must look at those memories, and if they're in art, a lot of art isn't true in an objective sense. Coming back to where we started, I might draw a picture that has it has barbaric representations of things that never happened, but it's a true expression of my emotion, and the emotion that's produced by my memories, and I look at that and I think, wow, I want to know more about that. So I think if we're talking about how to perpetuate, I'm still quite a long way away from the law being the solution. I think it gives space, but I'm much more with you. Let's get some more education and art.
But in relation, well, before touching on education,
yeah.
my contribution, my equivalent of your daughter's experience is once I'm feeling quite fragile, going to the cinema when it was first out to see Schindler's List, and realising that I really wasn't up to it. And I went to see this without Farron said.
Yeah.
John referred to those individuals in the Islamic world who indulge in spiritual theories about marriage. Actually, much more sinister, and in a sense, one would think, much more easy to eradicate. Are those significant sections of the Islamic community who think that the protocols of the Garden of Zion is true? I was reading a piece yesterday where a journalist said, well, I bought my copy in an Islamic bookshop in South London.
Yes.
And this is where I think that we're back to truth. And also the armour-plated quality that myth often has.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what good historical work has done to expose this as a fantasy and conspiracy by the Tsarist police. It simply doesn't matter. And indeed, part of it, I think, taken from some sort of other work by some 19th century French journalists. That doesn't matter. The objective historical truth about the protocols can't get through the myth. It's more complicated.
Well, there you are. The dangers of constructed memory.
Well, that's true. That there's also a way that we construct memory that is reassuring to us. I was reading a book in the last few weeks about a Polish woman who had served as a British secret agent during the Second World War. And it's a very, very powerful story because it was an extraordinary life. But it's also a very powerful story because it reminds in great detail how badly Britain treated Poland and treated Polish people. Both people who had served on the Allied side and the country as a whole, which was largely abandoned to the brutality of Stalin. And so on the one hand, there's the question of how other people treat these issues of memory. But we can talk about that in a relatively reassuring way. What for me was quite horrible in a way about reading the book was how, as a country, we have forgotten how badly we treated our own allies in a not very long ago conflict. And I think that's an aspect of remembering things too. It's this dilemma of remembering things so that they can't be made into memories proper and let go. And when Chancellor Merkel came to visit Westminster a few months ago, I was completely astonished when she came to address the two Houses of Parliament. She started her speech, saying, I'm really delighted to be here. It is great to be able to be here in Britain and to say to British people how much we appreciate the way you stood against us in the last World War and protected the whole of Europe from the horrible things we Germans were doing. Started her speech in that way. So it's not just that Jewish people haven't been able to get over the Holocaust. The German people haven't been able to get over the Holocaust either and find a way of processing it. But in a sort of way, in the United Kingdom, we've also constructed a narrative about how we were on the good guys' side and forgot all the horrible things we did, including to our own allies who were abandoned for the sake of politics at the time. And I'm not saying that we should have done something different. In war, only horrible things happen, in truth. And maybe one of the great dangers for this generation is forgetting how horrible war is, which makes another war much more likely. But I just, it's this business of memory and the too much remembering, but there's also the constructing of a memory which is reassuring to us that we were actually the good guys, and it wasn't quite as simple as that.
Because isn't the truth that memory is never going to be comprehensive? I'm not sure by definition, but certainly in practice, it's never going to be. So you're always going to pick certain things to obsess about. I mean, memory is, perhaps by definition, memory is a little obsession. Because if it isn't particularly important, I don't remember it. So the fact that I remember it means I've chosen it as being particularly important. And obsession, I think you will tell us, is always a dangerous thing.
It's not always a bad thing, but it is always dangerous.
Of course, it is. One picks up memory and memory and history stand at the polar opposite of law. There is no equivalent in history and memory to the idea of res judicata. But that's it. We've made the decision. Move on. And that's a hugely useful thing internally for law to have, that capacity to make the decision. Well, that's it. Let's move on. History.
Yeah, I agree with that.
That's a continuous conversation because the book that you read, John, about the contribution of a particular Polish woman to the Allied war effort, that's recently published. Doubtless, a couple of years time or something else, shading her perspective, putting the perfection of it, whatever. History doesn't stop because we continue to make it.
Well, you're absolutely right. And in fact, in the case of this particular woman, some friends of hers for many years stopped books being published about her because they felt that they weren't going to present the kind of picture that they wanted. And then one or two books got published and people, well, that's not actually true. And then, of course, 35 and 40 years later, material begins to become available from public records that wasn't available. So you're absolutely right. It's a continuing process for all of us, for good and ill.
Should we start